Don't worry. You won't need an interpreter for this.
Philosophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?
It is time for a Too Wretched for Radio with the one, with the only, with the what kind of a shirt are you wearing today? Phil Johnson. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, that's my old style Rick Warren costume.
If it weren't for the vast difference in your theology, I would have confused the two of you straight away. Actually, that almost looks like an old Team Pyro shirt that you've got on.
No, it's just a Hawaiian print shirt.
It's a beauty. All right, just for yucks, I know that I get the sense from you because, you know, I have that gift of discernment. I have this sense from you that you don't like talking about the number of pounds that you've successfully lost on your diet. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
See, listen to the reticence. If reticence were a food, this would be like the old country buffet. I'd have a massive amount of reticence in front of me. How much?
I'm consciously trying to lose weight, so, yeah.
How much? Come on.
So far, I've lost about 70 pounds since last Christmas.
That's just outstanding. Make sure you do it in a healthy way, you know.
Yeah, well, I have been, actually. People keep asking me what program I'm on or what diet I'm on or whatever. I just decided, you know what, I'm going to cut my calorie intake, and so I carefully record how much I eat every day and try to keep the calories below 1,500 each day. And
1,500?
Yeah, but see, that way I can eat anything I want. It's just a much lesser amount than I'm accustomed to, and pretty soon you adapt to that. I don't really feel hunger pangs or anything. I'm fine.
So in other words, you could just have a Krispy Kreme each day, and that would be it.
Yeah, that's about right. So yeah, no, I don't eat Krispy Kreme. But I've never been a fan of sweets anyway. So that's not really a temptation to me. It's if I have my choice between.
Oh, but when the light is on at the Krispy Kremes, how can you not go?
Yeah, I mean, it's great and everything, but it's just not, it isn't worth the amount of calories it costs. So, oh well.
All right, now, I do have to ask, will you be willing to go to an ice cream parlor when you're in town for our Facebook Live event?
Sure, yeah, I'll go to an ice cream parlor with you.
I just snuck that in so I can let everybody know. It looks pretty good. We're going to be doing a Facebook Live event coming up, give or take about a month. You can see the details at the website. We'll talk about it a fair amount. Phil Johnson flying from Los Angeles to Atlanta just to talk about a couple of people that a lot of people are questioning these days. And I told you, Phil, we are going to work you like a Grand Canyon mule. We are just going to have you talk and talk and talk and record all kinds of goodies with Phil Johnson. That, give or take, August 19th and 20th. Are you ready for today's festivities?
I am as ready as I will ever be. Let's say it like that.
One of the preachers that was still is very popular, I suppose, who appears to have perhaps chosen a different theological path would be Francis Chan, Mr. Crazy Love. He was pastoring a very large church in Sonoma? No, that's not right.
No, it was Simi Valley.
That's the one right there. Simi Valley. That is correct. He had a very big church. We actually did a conference there a number of years ago, a Transformed conference. Well, since then, was it Mike Gendron that he kind of chased out of the pulpit? Do you remember that story, Phil?
I don't know that story, no.
Okay, well, I feel pretty confident that I've got this correct. I believe they had Mike Gendron come in to talk about the differences between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. And Mike, straight shooter, made it very clear, just like the Reformers did, no, we are not together in the gospel or just about anything else for that matter. And apparently Francis got up, went up, asked him to leave.
Wow.
That's the story that I heard.
It's never happened to me that they've asked me to leave, but Wow.
They've thought it, though.
I'm sure they have. I am sure they have. Occasionally, when I listen to recordings of myself speaking, I sometimes think, I wish they'd ask me to quit.
Francis Chan quit his church, and now he's apparently starting up home churches in San Francisco and perhaps elsewhere. Not all that recently, but somewhat recently, he decided to come out and talk about speaking in tongues because it would appear that he has evolved in his position. Phil, I'm going to play what Joey deemed to be the highlights of this presentation, although I will have to tell you, Joey, who chops up a lot of sermons for us, he's always the guy who prepares, like when we chop you up, it's Joey, radio, TV. So he listens to all kinds of sermons all the time. And he said, I just struggled with this so much because it was so disjointed. There was no real outline per se. So this is the best of. I'll play it. You say stop when you can take it no more.
I just want to be cautious. I've been very sure about things in the past and have said things
okay.
Very strongly, even abrasively.
Stop.
And
okay, I didn't think you were jumping that quickly. All right, go.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard this. All right, just so you know, I don't really follow Francis Chan that much, and I have not heard this message. It's my first introduction to it, but I can tell already where he's going, and it's going to be an echo of that same sort of postmodern tendency to canonize doubt as a virtue. So rather than faith, now we want to talk about our doubts. We want to slam things like certainty and assurance. And let's be transparent about the things we're not sure of. And let's not be sure about things that once we were. And somehow that's supposed to be a virtue, that I've lost my confidence in whatever my creed or confession of faith used to be. I don't believe that anymore. That was such a common theme among the emerging church guys that I actually critiqued it quite a bit when I was blogging a decade ago or so. And I remember one article I wrote about it that you might Google and find some help with this whole subject was titled A Certain Uncertainty. The only thing some of these guys want to be certain about is their uncertainty. What that does is it removes any sort of boundaries or doctrinal limitations so that they can embrace or say just about anything and at the same time more or less avoid critique because they're not dogmatically stating anything other than their own doubts. And so they think that somehow makes them exempt from any kind of critique or criticism, and it just seems to be where he's already going with this. I want to be careful, he says, because in the past I was so sure about things, and now he's clearly not feeling so certain anymore, and so he's about to canonize his own doubts.
All right, two responses to your response to Francis Chan. Number one, if you do not tweet, it is a virtue to canonize doubt. I'm going to take it, and that is very pithy and very punchy. That is a seeming trend. It was the emergent movement, but it's still going on in evangelical Christianity, typically with people who are in more conservative denominations, who tend to be more liberal, who are looking to subvert, and they don't want to overtly state, hey, look, this, I think we should all be speaking in tongues. You know, just kind of talk about it and not be certain. It seems like it's the camel's nose all over again.
No question about it. And in fact, I think what we're seeing, Todd, is a resurgence of the attitudes underlying the emerging movement that was such a big thing a decade ago. The movement died, but the ideas didn't. And I even made the comment at the time that
that's right.
This movement may die as a movement, but all those postmodern ideas and attitudes that were so venerated by the emerging church have been now sown into the younger generation of people who grew up in evangelical circles, and they're like so many dandelion seeds. It's going to erupt into a new field of weeds, and I think that's what we're seeing now with all the emphasis on social justice, the social gospel, this canonization of doubt. These were all themes of the emerging church movement. And though the movement couldn't sustain itself, it collapsed on itself, the beliefs and attitudes are still with us and still need to be opposed.
Okay, well, here's the question I have for you. How many texts do you get in an hour? Wow, you're dinging like nobody's business there. If it's anything urgent with the family, you tell me. We will put a fork in this. It'll be done.
No, I'm sorry you can hear it. I wish there was a way to silence my text messages.
Dinger.
Yeah, sorry.
You know, I remember a number of years ago, I was with a fella in his office, books everywhere and what have you, and his phone rang on his, whatever you call that piece of equipment, that credenza behind you.
Yeah.
And he turned and he looked at it and he goes, it's just my wife. And he didn't take the call. Oh, wrong, sir. Do you remember another trend? I just heard Alistair Begg talking about this from an older sermon. It was the transparency theme, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just a struggler.
That's part of the same thing.
And I look at porn too, and blap.
That is definitely a part of this same thing. That when you hear people, you know, talking about transparency, it's usually not honesty that they, you know, just sheer candor that they venerate, because they don't want you to be honest with them. But again, it's just a vehicle for people expressing their doubts or their qualms about doctrines that they've come to see as too narrow, because frankly, the world will always put pressure on biblical Christianity, telling us that our views are too narrow and we need to get with the times, and all these things come up in every new generation. And to say, you know, that too much certainty is a bad thing and it's better to be transparent about your qualms is to open the door. Actually, what it does is it kicks genuine, settled conviction right out the door.
Yeah, which is precisely the thing that's needed all the time in the church. These transparency guys that would talk about their sins and how they struggle and how they, I'm just like you. Here's my question for you, Phil. Pastors, they do sin. I've seen it a couple of times. Pastors do sin. So how does a pastor demonstrate that he is more spiritually mature, that he's the spiritual elder of the church, and yet not try to make himself look like he's a perfect saint?
Yeah, I mean, I don't claim to be a perfect saint, but I don't want to suggest to anybody that it's okay to live with your sins. It's okay to mollycoddle your own doubts.
That's exactly what I think that movement is all about.
Yeah.
It's just a downplaying of sanctification. That's what I think.
Yeah, no question about it. You notice anytime a pastor does sin and it becomes a notorious scandal, and more often than not, they try to return to the ministry. And there'll be a bunch of people who say things like, well, it's okay. I like having a pastor who's human, who knows what it's like to struggle with sin. And what they're actually feeling, I fear, is that they think that this somehow justifies their own sin so that they can maybe give up the struggle against the flesh a little bit and live with the sins they enjoy.
Then should they get caught in their sin? Hey, I told you so. All right, here was my second comment to your comment about Francis Chan, and I think we're making great time today. He sounds like he's trying for the third way option. We see this, the conversation in the Anglican Communion over sexual issues. Like, there's some people who think that only a man and a woman should get married. Other people think that it can be two fellas, two girls. The third way is we just kind of live together with this tension and, you know, it's all okay. That's what I think he's doing with this message, too.
Okay, I haven't heard enough of it to see that yet, but that would not surprise me. And I say watch, because in the next 6 months to a year, there's going to be a very strong and popular push for evangelicals to change their attitude about things like homosexual orientations and celibate homosexual relationships, supposedly, things like that. We're already being pressured to say that a homosexual desire in and of itself isn't necessarily sinful, that maybe it's okay to have a homosexual orientation as long as you're not committing fornication. I think this is going to become a larger and larger issue in evangelical circles, and I think it's going to decimate the movement, frankly, because I don't see a lot of evangelicals with the doctrinal fortitude to take a stand on an issue that is going to make us grossly unpopular with the secular world.
Well, there is something about the argument from the Revoice conference of, hey, as long as you don't act on it, and on the surface, that maybe sounds pretty appealing to somebody, but we've got to dig biblically. And what I think just clarifies it, Phil, if I said to you, nice to meet you, Phil, I'm Todd, I'm an adulterer Christian. Well, look, I don't act on it, but that's just the way I'm bent toward having adulter. I'm a raping Christian. I'm a murder. I'm a beating up children Christian. I don't still beat them up, but I've just got that bent. You'd go, whoa, something is really wrong here. And that, I think, is what we need to keep in mind, because Revoice is going to reverberate with the message, as long as you don't act on it, you're fine.
Right. And in fact, there's already that slippery slope. The evidence you can see, especially in the secular world, there are voices, not as many as there are arguing for acceptance of homosexuality, but there are a few voices saying, well, look, I was born with an orientation towards sexual relationships with children. I'm a pedophile by nature. That's my orientation.
No. You're a, MAPS. You are a minor attracted person. You're not a pedophile anymore. You're a MAP.
Right. But it's the same thing. And it's the same arguments. It's the very same arguments. As long as I don't act on it, why can't I be a kindergarten teacher why can't I hang out in the park and take pictures of little children? As long as I'm not committing any sexual misbehavior.
Uh-huh.
And that's where this is going. And honestly, if it begins to be embraced in churches, the churches will go all the way with it as well.
No, you can just feel it coming. Well, Phil, thanks for joining us today. Oh, wait, we're only 12 seconds into Francis Chan speaking in tongues.
And then later in life, searching scriptures more and going, ooh, I think I was really off on that. And so I just want to be careful.
I wish you'd give an example of what he's talking about, because I have no clue what he's talking about.
No, I do. I can tell you that, Phil. Everything that he learned at Master's Seminary, he now doubts.
Well, I know that, but as I've watched him, it seems to me that it's not that he's changed from a position of unclarity and half-baked argumentation to where now he's clear and he understands better, and here's why he was wrong. He's moved from clarity and settled conviction to this sort of amorphous doubt where he doesn't even bother to try to explain what it is he used to be so murky on, and now it's clear to him. He's making a generalization here, I think, whose only purpose is to justify his own self-doubt, his own wish to have a less narrow statement of faith.
Well, here he goes, trying to explain, praying and praising and speaking in tongues.
In verse 14, if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays.
Is he 1 Corinthians 14? Is that where he's at?
Yeah.
But my mind is unfruitful. Have you ever considered praying or praising while your mind is unfruitful?
Do you have any idea what he's talking about?
Well, I think he's trying to imply that, no, well, that's a good thing. And Paul is not saying that's a good thing. He's saying, look, that's a bad thing. If you think you can let your spirit go and have your mind be unfruitful, and that's a good thing, you're missing the point of... In fact, the context here makes very clear, because Paul's arguing that, look, these gifts are given for the edification of the body. And you're not edifying anybody if your intellect is unfruitful. That's Paul's complaint here. He's not saying, yes, do this because it's really good. The funny thing is, I was listening on the way in to this bizarre presentation by a charismatic woman who was saying that you can actually get angels to answer your difficult questions and problems while you sleep. So she's saying you're actually better in formulating your theology while you're asleep by doing it through your dreams and angelic messages than you are when you're awake, because when you're awake, your mind's too active, she says. So do your doctrine, learn your doctrine while you're asleep. The angels will teach you, and you may not understand it intellectually, but you'll have better theology, she says, if you settle your theological questions in your sleep. It's just ridiculous way to think. And that's the way, that's actually a close paraphrase of how Francis Chan just interpreted that verse.
Yeah, one of the most helpful ways to make your way through 1 Corinthians 14, I think the first time I saw this, Phil, was when I was reading all the footnotes of the John MacArthur Study Bible, tongue versus tongues. Huge difference. And I will say this again. I think understanding the difference between singular and plural, tongue versus tongues, makes 1 Corinthians 14 perfectly clear. And if we just stopped interpreting glossolalia as tongues and changed it to languages, I think the game would pretty much be over.
Yeah. And, you know, really, I would encourage anybody who might be confused about what Francis Chan is saying, just go and look at that passage in its context. That is 1 Corinthians 14. He cherry-picked verse 14, which is the one that says, if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my understanding is unfruitful. Let me get a version here that I can actually read from. But Paul has just been saying, look, in starting in verse 10, there are many different languages, and they all have meaning, he says. So he's saying the meaning is important. If I do not know the meaning of the language, I'll be a foreigner to the speaker, and he'll be a foreigner to me. So he says, with yourselves, since you are eager for manifestations of the Spirit, strive to excel in building up the church, edifying the church. Therefore, anyone who speaks in a tongue should pray for the power to interpret. Why? Because it's pointless, it's fruitless to pray in a tongue, and nobody knows what the meaning is. So you have to have an interpreter if it's going to be done right. And the next verse, he says, for if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my mind is unfruitful. He's not saying that's a good thing.
No.
He's saying you need an interpretation if you're going to edify.
Well, you know, context, schmontext. This is clip 3 from Francis.
I remember Sam talking about things that are transrational.
I think he's talking about Sam Storms.
Yeah, transrational.
Like, we're not talking about irrational, but it's beyond just anything good must pass through this cognitive part of my brain in order for it to be a good thing.
Okay, stop it.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Now, see, he's just made a distinction there that really is without any value whatsoever. What is the difference between transrational and irrational? He says it's not irrational. It's just beyond rational. But that's kind of meaningless. He's saying it's not rational. And then he denigrates the idea that anything that should have meaning or be edifying in any way needs to pass through your cognitive faculties. Of course it does. That's the whole point Paul is making in the very text he's quoting from. But go ahead.
Well, see, to me, this goes back to, this isn't just cherry-picking a verse in 1 Corinthians 14. It's also forgetting, well, you know, pretty much the rest of the Bible, that God is an intelligent being. We're created in his image. He communicates through languages. He puts those things down so that we can have them for generations to think about, dwell on his word, think on his word, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. He's just forgetting a whole lot of Bible.
How else are we going to explain the Spirit crying out, Abba, Father?
Okie dokie. So, well, let me tell you what I think he's saying. I think he's saying that sometimes we just have these experiences. We can't really articulate what's going on, but somehow it must be some sort of divine encounter, I think.
I think he is saying that, and it's close to something that's true, but he's totally misapplying it and turning what Paul's saying in 1 Corinthians 14 on his head. What he's referring to is in Romans 8, where he says the Spirit makes intercession for us with, you know, he prays to the Father with groanings that can't be uttered. There are times when we can't put our feelings into words. That's something coming from me that I want to express to God, but I can't put it into words. The Spirit helps us with that. But what he's saying here is that sometimes there's truth God wants to get to us that maybe just needs to bypass our brains. And that's That's pretty much the opposite of the way it works.
Well, that's mysticism. That's a degree of Gnosticism. It's paganism, but it's not Christianity. This is our final Francis Chan speaking in tongues. We'll call it a sermon to be charitable.
Here he's saying that, you know, when you're praising in the spirit, he goes, I want to do it, you know, with my spirit, but I also want to do it with understanding. But here he's clearly talking about tongues. If I speak in a tongue, my spirit prays, my mind is unfruitful. And in verse 16, that's when it? You are praising God in the spirit.
Okay. First of all, singular tongue. I'm now reading, I'm going back to 1 Corinthians 14:4. A tongue. Again, as in verse 2, Paul uses the singular to refer to the pagan counterfeit gibberish and sarcastically marks it selfishness as some kind of self-edification. And so, first of all, he's mangling the context, but he's misunderstanding what Paul is after.
And if you tried to follow him there with an open Bible, you'd see that he deliberately skipped major portions of the text.
Yep.
Listen to it, the whole text. Verse 14, the one he wants to camp on. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my mind is unfruitful. Then he asks, what am I to do? I will pray with my spirit, but I will pray with my mind also. I will sing praise with my spirit, but I will sing with my mind also. Otherwise, in other words, if you don't combine mind and spirit in something sensible, otherwise, if you give thanks with your spirit, how can anyone in the position of an outsider say amen to your thanksgiving when he doesn't know what you're saying? For you may be giving thanks well enough, but the other person is not being built up. So he's saying, if that's the way you practice it, if you do what Francis Chan is championing here, you are not using your spiritual gift for what it was intended for, namely, the edification of the body of Christ.
And this is the conclusion of the matter, presumably.
So this idea of praying in the Spirit, singing in the Spirit, praising in the Spirit, is it tongues? Yes, it is. But is it exclusively tongues? And that's where I don't think it is.
Okay. Honestly, you got anything on that, Phil?
No, I don't know where he was going with that, so I don't know. I don't know. But you said earlier, and I think this is a point that needs to be stressed, that this is a kind of paganism. And that's exactly right. One of the things that most pagan religions have in common is this notion that a connection with God must somehow bypass our minds, that we have to connect either emotionally or mystically or spiritually in some way that isn't rational in order to have a true experience with God. It's paganism that's crept into Christianity, and this is not something new that Francis Chan is proposing. This is what the charismatic movement has been arguing for years.
Phil, make a prediction. 6 months, 12 months, what's Francis up to?
Well, he's clearly moving deeper into charismatic circles, and I think you know, he'll emerge there as a kind of conference speaker, and he already has spoken at places like IHOP, and I wouldn't be very surprised if he, you know, forms a relationship with Bethel in Redding, California.
Oh yeah, I think that's already happened. Frankly, I think he's going to be preaching there soon with others. So I think so. But you know what? Hopefully, he can bump into Mark Driscoll at one of those charismatic conferences, and they can have themselves a good chat about theology.
Phil's Osophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?